We have around 700 LNG ships worldwide.
You take the gas into the liquefaction plant, you liquefy it by cooling it down, and that is a really fascinating experience.
Hello and welcome to Uniper's Market Insights. My name is Florian Oberländer, and a warm welcome to you out there, and of course a warm welcome to our audience today as well. And with his comeback to Uniper Market Insights, I'm happy to welcome Gregor Pett as well. Mm-hmm. Hi, Gregor.
Hi, Florian.
Thanks for coming back. And I talked to Jess Torpy in the last episode.
Yeah, I saw that.
Really great episode, special topic, weather, which is always interesting. So to you out there, if you haven't watched it and you need some advice on where to book your summer vacation, check out the last version. Jess gave some hints there as well. Mm-hmm. But we have interesting topics today as well. The main one is LNG and the impact it has on the markets, and also what role it plays in regards to the conflict in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But we will start with two short updates because they were in the news recently. Mm-hmm. The German power plant strategy, there has been an update. What exactly is behind it?
Yeah, so we've been waiting for that for a while, so it's very important. So just to recall the background, we need dispatchable capacity in the markets. So because of the fluctuation due to renewables infeed, because of the weather, so that links to the previous episode, we need capacity that can balance that. And there's a couple of gigawatts missing. So this is why this capacity is needed. And the German government is introducing tender procedures then for, in particular, that capacity. Mm-hmm. And as we explained in a previous episode, also these plants need to be paid for by capacity, not by the amount of power they produce, but rather they need to be there even if they don't produce that much, but just if the wind doesn't blow, the sun doesn't shine, they are there. So that's the background. The government has now provided a draft for the regulations for such tender procedures, which is now on the table. It's being consulted with industry associations and other stakeholders. And it's very important that it then goes into the legislative process and is decided by the government and then also by the parliament, of course. And so it can be implemented fairly quickly. The plan is to do the first tenders in September and December, and that would be very important so we can move that ahead and have an important step forward for more security of supply.
Yeah, I think we're talking about roughly 4.5 gigawatts.
For each tender.
If when I understand it correctly, they are aiming for the summer for it to pass. So maybe in one of the next episodes, we can then report on it.
And again, that would be very important. Mm.
Also in the news, the United Arab Emirates exited the OPEC. We previously discussed the role of the OPEC in this format as well. Mm-hmm. What is the reason behind it?
Yeah, so they are a major producer of oil. It's around 4 million barrels a day, so quite a major player in the oil market. And the OPEC, as a cartel, of course, introduces strict regulations for their members. So, for example, there are production quota which limit the amount of oil you can produce as a member state. And, of course, for a major player, that limits their flexibility then to market more or less depending on their preferences, their strategies, and also the investments they've made. And according to the announcement, they've now decided that they want more flexibility and more freedom. And the current situation in the Middle East, of course, has led to the conclusion that also they want to be flexible than reacting to those challenges. And that, according to their statement, is behind the decision.
Okay, understood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting to see that happening. But let's stay in that region. And of course, we want to talk about a little bit on the impact of the conflict in the Middle East. But of course, we are a format that analyzes energy markets. But of course, I want to mention here that, of course, it's a tragedy.
It's terrible for the people there.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we have teams on site as well that live and work there. And of course, we hope that the situation resolves better sooner than later as well. Yes, and when we look at the reporting of the conflict as well, there's always LNG that's mentioned. Mm. For the people that maybe have not heard about it before, what is behind LNG?
Yeah, LNG, it's basically the same as natural gas. So it shares the same production process, but then it's cooled down and it becomes liquid at minus 162 degrees Celsius. And so the volume is much smaller. So it can be loaded on ships and transported in an efficient way. So that's basically what's behind LNG. So what you do is you take the gas into the liquefaction plant, you liquefy it by cooling it down, and then you put it on those ships. It's basically pumped on these ships. These ships have tanks, and it's not that these tanks are under pressure, but they are cooled down and they are very well insulated. And some of the LNG boils off, and that keeps the entire load cool, so it can be transported over several days then from the liquefaction point to the point where it's regasified, which means then it's returned to its gaseous state and fed into the distribution grid in the import country or in the recipient country.
Yeah. Okay, understood. Then. Why is everybody talking about LNG over the last couple of years as well?
Well, LNG has really made the gas market global. So that's really behind that. So it's been there for a while, but very often that has been then point-to-point production. But now, since a couple of years, it's really been global. There's a lot of flexibility in there. And a cargo, similar to oil, has the advantage that you can instead of going from A to B, it can go from A to C. Yeah, and so you are quite flexible in optimizing where it goes. So, and you can do that depending on the price or where shortages occur. And it's really a global optimization of these flows. And LNG has enabled that.
So when we look at the conflict in the Middle East, and of course the Straits of Hormuz are a bottleneck there, has that led to the increased prices?
Yeah. Definitely, yes. So first of all, for Europe, LNG has become very important as well. So because a lot of the Russian gas that was cut off is being replaced by LNG deliveries, many of them for Europe coming out of the US, because the US has very much increased their production capacity over the next couple of years, and they will continue to do so. Mm-hmm. And in the Middle East, a lot of the LNG that is consumed worldwide goes through the Straits of Hormuz, which is a very, very narrow straits out of the Gulf region. Yeah, and like 20% of world LNG have to go through that bottleneck. And due to the conflict, this has been blocked, which means then this LNG is basically trapped in the Gulf region, can't get out.
Yeah.
And this has led to these price spikes, because everybody now who gets LNG out of the Gulf region needs to replace it. Okay. Which is in particular true for Asian countries. So there are countries like Pakistan who are very much almost entirely dependent on LNG from the Gulf region. China also, but not to that extent, and they also can switch, they have alternatives. Japan is another example.
Yeah.
So these countries need to replace the LNG they lose, because it can't get out. And so everybody's now competing for cargos then to replace the cargos that are trapped. Europe is less dependent on LNG, so there's no there's very limited direct deliveries from the Gulf region into Europe. There is some, but it's limited. But still, for the cargoes Europe wants to buy on the short term, the spot markets, where you buy short term deliveries, we very much compete with all the countries in Asia, and that of course has moved the prices up significantly.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, we at Uniper we don't have supply from there.
Correct.
But it's definitely something we observe closely as well. Let's stay with what I found very interesting. The ships for a second here. What's the specialty of these ships?
So they are fascinating vehicles. So first of all, they are over 300 meters long, and they capture like 1 terawatt hour of gas, which means it's like 70,000 households for 1 year. And so it's quite a size. And the crew actually is very small, so it's like 30 people on such a ship. And they are really specialized people, very highly qualified, amongst the highest qualifications in the maritime sector. And it's really fascinating to see them at work.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you've
been on a ship like this?
Yeah, that's I've seen that at work, and that is a really fascinating experience.
Yeah, very fascinating topic, size-wise even. And I looked it up as well. We have around 700 LNG ships worldwide right now, and the aim is to have 50% more by 2030. So ambitious goal. What do you expect is the cost to build a ship like this, roughly?
Well, I guess, so they're mainly made in South Korea and China, I think. So I guess between $200 and $300 million.
Around that, yeah, $250 is the average. So you're on spot there, and yeah, charter costs per day are around €70,000, given the length of the contract, the charter, and of course the change. And
I mean that changes. Of course, it's very expensive at the moment because it's in high demand. Ships are in high demand because of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a team that analyzes just that within Uniper as well. So
absolutely, and they've been trading 170 cargoes last year. Yeah. So, and we own also four ships ourselves, and so we are quite experienced in that business.
Two of them are called Schneeweißchen and Rosenrot. Very creative.
So very nice names from German fairy tales.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So that's the Uniper reference then, I guess, there. Mm-hmm. Let's look at export and imports. What are the main countries that export?
Yeah, so I mean, Qatar, obviously, in the Gulf region is a major exporter, and they've been planning to expand their capacity significantly. But the biggest player is the U.S., and they've basically risen from, they thought they would import by 2020, but then it turned around due to the shale gas they produce in the country, and have become the largest, the biggest exporter of LNG in the world.
I want to come back to Qatar in a minute, but let's look at the imports first. Who are the main importers?
Well, that's China and Japan mainly, but also Europe is growing. Europe as a whole, if you take it together, is a major importer. Japan has traditionally been the biggest importer of LNG, but has been surpassed by China a couple of years ago. And so these are the big ones because of the economic growth in China in particular, and they needed the LNG to fuel that. And in Europe, as I mentioned, because of the reduction of Russian pipeline gas, that gas needed to be replaced, and LNG was the answer for that one, which made Europe also a big importer.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back to Qatar for a minute, because there were some news about damages to the infrastructure. Yeah. I think Iran attacked Qatar. Mm. What are the details behind that?
Yeah, well, there's two problems. The first is that this blockade of the Straits of Hormuz has prevented LNG from coming out of the Gulf and to be delivered to the customers. And in addition to that, the production facilities in Qatar were hit by Iranian missiles. And it's the biggest LNG liquefaction plant in the world, Ras Laffan. And that has been hit by missiles, and the repair will take a while, and that is of course significant for the market.
Yeah, of course. And when we look at Europe and also security of supply, if we look at that, and you know, we are talking about this quite frequently now with the geopolitical situation like this. Yeah, like we mentioned, Uniper is not getting LNG supply from that region. However, you know, looking at the just sheer size of regas capacities like Ras Laffan there, I wanted to highlight a few numbers there. To invest into an onshore terminal or to build one, you're looking at roughly $1 billion, so quite a significant amount. And looking at sizes of the storage on site of around 250,000 cubic meters, which is the size of, I looked it up, 100 Olympic swimming pools.
Oh,
so quite huge. And we also have a swimming alternative, like in Wilhelmshaven, FSRU, and which is also helping security of supply here in Europe. And something that we are, of course, you know, in discussing as well on the political stage at this point is the EU methane regulation. Why is this a topic when we look at security of supply?
Yeah, so where does it come from to start with? So the methane regulation regulates or tries to prevent, reduce methane emissions during the production, transport, and the consumption of natural gas. Why is that? Because methane is very bad for the climate. So it's much worse than CO2 when it comes to the greenhouse gas effect. Yeah. So which means it's important to prevent leakage of methane, and this is what the methane regulation is about. So to give an example, so it regulates that these emissions need to be monitored, then leakage needs to be detected and repaired. And practices like flaring of gas or basically expansion when it's set free in the atmosphere, these are prohibited. So for example, in the old days, when you had a compressor station, that is of course under pressure. If you need to repair it or maintain it, you need to get the gas out. And in the old days, it was let out in the atmosphere, which is of course very bad from a climate perspective. And that's now prohibited. And you have to kind of capture that gas and then use it, which is of course very good from an economic perspective, but of course even better from a climate environmental perspective. So these are examples why it makes sense to regulate these things. And the second step is also to look at imports of natural gas and to make people who want to import natural gas check the entire production and transport chain to make sure that you have investigated the emissions and that you have the producers are certified in a certain way, so you can be sure that what the methane emissions are in that process. And there the problem starts, because there's a lot of detail then to that, and maybe a lot of bureaucracy, and for a long time it has not been so clear how it's done specifically. And in addition to that, if you want to buy LNG, for example, to pick up that example, and you need to go through all this process and you need to investigate your producers, this of course adds complexity to making those deals, and it also puts you or may put you as a disadvantage in the competitive process of buying that LNG. So we need to balance security of supply, as in we need to contract LNG on a long-term basis for security of supply reasons. We need to balance that against climate protection and environmental aspects.
Okay, but isn't it tricky to measure these things, especially if you have a producer really far away in different countries?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at a country like the US, which is the biggest LNG exporter, as we said earlier, and there is hundreds or thousands of producers and individual in-feed points, where producers feed the gas into the grid, and all of these you need to look at, and then it's fed into the pipeline system. It's transported to the Gulf Coast, where most of the LNG export terminals are. And of course, this is a very complicated process. It's not like there's one producer and that producer can check all of that. It's a lot of them.
Sounds very tricky.
Yeah, it's tricky.
All right, let's check this off, and we come to the last segment, which is one of my favorite ones, the questions of our trainees. And this time, Zoe had two questions to us. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Gregor. I'm Zoe. Nice to meet you. And I have two questions today for you. So my first one is about young professionals and what they should keep in mind if they want to build a successful career in the energy market. And my second question is, to what extent are the European energy markets actually interconnected, and why is this so relevant in the times of increasing energy demand? Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to hear your answers.
All right, I would say that we start with how is Europe connected energy-wise? Let's start with that.
Yeah, it's very connected, and that's very important. It's been a target of the EU for a long time to connect energy markets. And for example, in the power markets, we have very close connections, also very near term. So the exchanges are connected, so there are automatic algorithms in place that connects those marketplaces. And there's also common reserve energy markets. And that has been a big success. So in Central Europe, that's very connected. We have also have interconnected to the Nordic countries, a bit less to the Iberian Peninsula, countries like Spain, Portugal. That's because that's difficult to get across the Pyrenees. On the gas side, similarly, probably not that close, but very close, very well connected. Also, the industry managed successfully the change of the flows when the Russian gas was cut off. Yeah, so the flows, which historically all came from east to west, had to be reversed in some cases. So there needed to be some technical adaptations to make that possible, and that was done. So the connectivity is a very important aspect of European security of supply, mm-hmm. from, for example, LNG to pipeline, and so we have that flexibility.
Okay. So yeah, I hope your question is answered. I think it was really, really good and understandable. Second question, or the first one from Zoe, what does a new starter bring to the table entering the energy sector? Very good.
Yes.
It's been a while for us, but you start.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the industry for over 30 years now, and it's never been boring. So that's I can promise that to everyone, who wants to start in the industry. First of all, there is a lot of change, so you need to be able to adjust to that. But mm-hmm. also the change cycle is due to the investment cycles a longer one. So sometimes you need to be patient, mm-hmm. And sometimes you need to be agile to follow these developments. So it's an interesting combination. For me, it was always important the purpose of what we are doing. So energy is about economy. It's about the lives of people and to help them. And for me, it always felt that helping to make that work gives me a purpose in working here. So if that resonates with people, that would probably make them want to work in the industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing is so being a bit analytical is also helps, because energy has got a lot to do with numbers, with analytics, both economic and technical. So if you bring that to the table, that's really helpful.
Yeah. Well said. And it never gets boring. I can just underline that. Maybe just to add from my side, I mean, I think it's always good to bring flexibility and just going for it. I never went to university. I have a hotel background, so something completely different. But my flexibility allowed me to work in HR. I did trading also, and mm-hmm. now ended up in communications. And I'm allowed to ask you tricky questions. And so I would just say, if you're interested in it, just go for it. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can fully support that.
Good deal. All right. Zoe, hopefully everything's answered. And my questions were all answered by you today as well. So thank you very much for all of your insight. And I see you in the next round again.
Yeah, thank you very much, Florian.
All right. And to you out there, thank you very much for listening or watching. Hope you tune in next time again. Until then, bye-bye.